Now we come to the first essay. Rudolf Steiner starts. He says, research into the nature of the human being can be considered as the most worthy branch of human research since the most ancient times. However, the person who permits to work upon himself what in the course of the time of period has appeared as knowledge of the human being, that person can very easily be discouraged. A fullness of opinions offers itself as answers to the question, what is the human being, and what relationship does he possess to the cosmic all? And when you contemplate the answers to this particular question, it shows the most manifold differences. And from this fact, you can get the impression that man is not called upon to such a sort of research, and that he must renounce the ability to reach anything which can offer satisfaction to the feeling of that it's the most worthy branch of human research, this investigation of the nature of the human being. It's such an impression that man is not called upon to make such a research into the nature of the human being. Is it really justified? However, this impression would be justified only if the perception of the different viewpoints about an object were a proof of the fact that man is incapable of knowing anything true about that object. A person who would want to assume such a proof, that person would have to believe that the whole nature of an object all at once could disclose itself to the human being in the course of his desire to know about this object. Well, it is a fact that human knowledge is not constituted in such a way that it can have revealed to itself all at once the essential nature of things. With this human knowledge, it is rather much more so as to be compared with the picture, for example, that you might have of a tree from a certain side, and you either paint it from a certain aspect, or you can make a photograph of it. This picture would provide the full truth about the tree only as to how it appears when viewed from a certain aspect. If you would choose an entirely different point of vision, so the picture becomes quite different. And it's only when you have a series of pictures taken from the different aspects can you get a total idea of the nature of the tree by putting them all together. This is the only way in which the human being can observe the things and beings of the world. Everything which he might be permitted to discuss and say about these things and beings of the world, he must realize are viewpoints which are valid only from certain definite aspects. This applies not only when you observe things and objects from the sense aspect, but it also applies when you have to deal with the world of the spiritual. But in reference to this comparison of the research into the spiritual, you should not allow yourself to be confused by the previous comparison and make some sort of idea that in the point of the case of the spirit, you're dealing with different aspects which are concerned with those aspects of a spatial nature, because the world of the spirit is outside space. Now, every viewpoint can be a true viewpoint if it is a true representation of that which is being observed. And it can only be refuted if it can be proven that from the same point of view, you can arrive at a different justified observation. But when there is a different observation, when this observation is taken from another point of view, then that really shouldn't worry you. The person who understands the matter in this way, he is protected against the very easy objection that every opinion, when grasped in such an aspect, must appear to be justified. Mansell speaking, if you don't understand this sentence, neither do I, but don't let it bother you. Steiner sometimes makes a very simple statement, which he repeats what he said before, but he makes this statement in such a Teutonic double talk way that you think he's saying something but you don't understand. So don't bother about the fact you can't understand this sentence, okay? Of course, the thought he's presenting now is the most simple thought you could ever imagine. It's over a page to make the simple statement that if you want to know about the thing, you must approach the thing from varied aspects and then put them together. Say that simply and leave it alone and get on to the next part is not Steiner's style. Look at the manuscript. Just as the picture of a tree must have a certain definite form when viewed from one particular point of view, so also a spiritual point of view is regarded as valid also from one particular point of view. And so the only time you can accuse something of being a mistake, if you can regard that particular so-called mistake from the same point of view as the person who asserts that so-called mistake. You can't say it's wrong when you see something different from a different aspect. One will be able to deal much better with different opinions by human beings when you really take this particular aspect in your mind. And then you become aware how the difference of opinions which people have in many cases emanate from the fact that they are considering the matter from different points of view. But only by taking these different points of view can you approach closer to the essential nature of things. So the mistake which is made in this direction emanates not from the fact that people develop different viewpoints, but when an individual makes the assertion that his own viewpoint is the only justifiable one. It's quite easy to raise an objection against all this. Say that man, if he wants to represent the truth, must not yield himself to one particular point of view, but must lift himself up to all possible points of view so as to arrive at a total grasping of some particular thing. And this demand can appear to be sound very acceptable. However, it is not capable of fulfillment. Because what a thing is must be designated from the different points of view. The mentioned picture of the tree, which appears when you paint it from different points of view, that appears to be applicable. The person who rejects this taking together of different pictures in order to acquire a total picture, that person, if he wants to, can perhaps paint something which is quite verschwommenes, something of a cloudy nature, misty nature, of things swimming together. However, in such a verschwommenes picture, there could be no truth. So there is also no truth capable of being acquired by a knowledge which wants to span just one view of the object. But truth can be acquired only by putting together the true viewpoints which are yielded from the different standpoints. Human impatience might not like this very much. However, this corresponds to the facts which one is able to learn if you are striving towards a comprehensive striving for knowledge. Such a striving for knowledge can strongly lead to a genuine estimation of the truth. This estimation of the truth is designated as genuine because it cannot result from any faint-heartedness. This does not lead to a doubt in reference to your striving towards the truth, because you recognize truth existing in such limitations. However, it is a protection against the contentless pride which a person who thinks he possesses the truth can experience. A person who sufficiently understands what I've just said, he will find it understandable that in particular knowledge of the human being should be so strived for that man would attempt to approach this knowledge by approaching it from different points of view. And it's such a point of view which is selected for the following indications. I'm going to characterize such a thing which lies in the middle between two others. You shouldn't immediately assert that besides the three points of view which are being considered here, there may be many other points of view. Nevertheless, I'm going to select these three points of view as being characteristic. Brain cells speaking. In case you've forgotten, Rudolf Steiner starts off by saying it's very important. People have always felt it's most important to understand the nature of man. Then he says that this is more of a spiritual thing, and so it's just as important as in physical things to see things from different aspects, so it's important in spiritual things. What Rudolf Steiner is going to talk about now are the three ways of looking at man from the point of view of anthropology, theosophy, and anthroposophy. Also, I'd like to point out, this is not a lecture I'm translating. This is something that Rudolf Steiner wrote in the year 1910. You might say, why am I making a fuss like this? I am, because I very strongly have experienced people simply cannot stand this long-winded Teutonic approach when a simple thing is gone round and round the mulberry bush, instead of getting right into a subject. The Teutonic mind loves this sort of wallowing in these ideas, but the Anglo-Saxon mind can't stand it. The Anglo-Saxon writer would start by saying, we're going to consider this subject, we're going to consider the character of anthroposophy in the following way. We're going to talk about the nature of man as has been interpreted from the point of view of anthropology, theosophy, and anthroposophy. And then go into the bloody subject. That would be too simple and direct. The Teutonic mind has to just go gradually, very gradually, and they sort of tease you on and on. If you have enough patience to wallow through it, fine. If not, bugger you. I'm flogging a dead horse when I raise this question again and again. This is the most significant point which causes a rejection of Rudolf Steiner's work in the Anglo-Saxon world. They simply can't go through it. In the manuscript, Rudolf Steiner continues, the first point of view which in such a connection comes into consideration is the point of view of anthropology. This science gathers together that which is yielded by the sense observation about the human being and attempts out of the results of their observation to achieve information about the nature of the human being. It considers, for example, how the senses are organized. It considers the formation, the build of the bones. It considers the relationship of the nervous system. It considers the processes involved in the muscle movements. Through its methods, it penetrates into the finer structure of the organs and attempts to learn the conditions at the basis of feeling and of thinking, etc. It researches also the similarity of the human being with the animal kingdom and attempts to win an idea of the relationship in which man stands to other living beings. It goes further and investigates the life relationships of the Naturvölker, the native people, the natives, who, in reference to the civilized peoples, appear to have been retarded in their development. And as a result of that, which they observe when investigating such native people, they get ideas of how the more developed people once upon a time were. People who have advanced beyond the degree of their development upon which the native people have remained standing. It investigates the remains of human being of primeval time in the layers of the earth and forms concepts about the fact how the cultural development has progressed forward. It investigates the influence of the climate, of the oceans, of the geographical relationships upon human life. It attempts to win a viewpoint about the conditions of race development, about the conditions of the way people live together, about the relationships of jurisprudence, about the formation of writing, of speaking. Here, the name of anthropology is used to describe the total physical knowledge of the human being. And to it is reckoned not only that which one, generally speaking, in a narrow sense, reckons to anthropology, but you reckon to anthropology also the morphology, biology, etc. Now, as a general rule, anthropology holds itself within those limits which one today regards as those appropriate to the natural scientific methods. And so, a powerful mass of facts through anthropology has been brought together. And in spite of the different ways of ideation in which this material is grasped together, nevertheless, there is contained in it something which can work in a most beneficial way upon the knowledge of the human being. All this material is continuously increasing itself. It corresponds to the points of view, the conceptions of the present day, to place the great hopes upon that which from this side of anthropology can be acquired in order to throw light upon the riddle of man. And it is quite obvious that many of the points of view of anthropology considered to be just as certain as those points of view which I shall now characterize are considered to be doubtful. The point of view which I'm now going to characterize, which is just considered by this anthropology who considers their knowledge to be certain and this knowledge of theosophy to be uncertain. And this other viewpoint is that of theosophy. This designation of theosophy is fortunate or unfortunate, I'm not going to talk about now. All I consider it as representing a second point of view in relationship to the consideration of the human being and is presented as a comparison to that of the anthropological. Theosophy starts from the aspect that man above all things is a spiritual being, and it attempts to know him as such and to research him from his aspect as being a spiritual being. It has in its mind the fact that the human soul shows itself not only as in a mirror. Human soul reflects the sense things and processes. The human soul is like a mirror which gives reflections of sense things and objects and works these over. Not only that is this soul exposed to the sense world, but also it is able to lead its own life and can receive its stimulation and its content from another side, which you call the spiritual. It maintains that man can penetrate into a spiritual domain just as he is able to penetrate into a sense domain. In this sense domain, man expands his knowledge of the human being through the fact that he directs his senses upon more and more things and processes, and upon the basis of this, he forms his concepts and ideas. In the spiritual domain, knowledge strides forward, to be sure, in a different way. In the spiritual domain, the observations are made there within an inner experience. A sense object there is in front of the human being. A spiritual experience rises up out of his inner being, lifting itself up as if out of the center point of the human being. Now, as long as man fosters the belief that such a rising up from out of his inner being is only an inner concern of the soul, as long as you believe that, then theosophy will appear to him to be highly doubtful. Of course, such a belief does not exist very far from the other belief, which assumes that such experiences are only further inner workings over of that which you had previously observed in a sense way. It is possible only to maintain such a belief as long as man has not yet created through urging reasons the conviction that from a certain point those inner experiences, just as the sense facts, are determined by something which in reference to the human personality is an external world. Mansell speaking, let me interpret for you this Teutonic double talk. What Rudolf Steiner is saying now is, some people believe that that which rises up out of your inner being is merely something worked over from what you've seen in the external world. And he says, you can only maintain that viewpoint if you do not realize that man is exposed to an external spirit world just as he's exposed to an external physical world. That's all he's saying. To prove that's all he's saying, let me translate the next sentence. He says, if one has created for oneself this conviction, then you must recognize the existence of a spiritual external world just as you recognize the existence of a physical external world. Then you'll be clear about the fact that man, in relationship to his spiritual aspect, is connected with a spiritual world, just as through his physical nature, he is rooted in the physical world. Then you will find it understandable that to acquire knowledge of the human being, we must take material out of this spiritual world, just as the anthropologist takes material out of the physical world in his observations. And then you will no longer doubt the possibility of research into a spiritual world. A spiritual researcher transforms his soul experience in such a way that the spiritual world enters into his soul experiences. He configures certain soul experiences in such a way that in these soul experiences, the spiritual world reveals itself. How that occurs, the writer of this sketch has presented in his book, How One Acquires Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. One can designate this so-configured soul life through the term clairvoyant consciousness. When you apply this concept, you must hold far from yourself all that nonsense which in the present time is dealt with this word clairvoyance. Well, Rudolf Steiner, I believe I have to apologize to you, because now I can see that you're writing this article not for the people, the usual theosophists or anthroposophists, but you're writing this for the general public. In the year 1910, when perhaps materialism was so great, took a great hold on this general public, that he had to go in this way in order to lift them out of their materialism. So I'm sorry, my criticisms, there you are. Okay. But I assure you, Rudolf Steiner, that the reading public in the English-speaking worlds is far more intelligent than you might believe. Maybe you know your German public better than we do. Back to the manuscript. So to arrive at inner experiences, so that the soul is able to directly reveal itself, these or that facts of the spiritual world, that requires long soul exertions of a laborious nature filled with renunciation. However, it would be a fateful prejudice if one would want to believe that only for those the fruits of soul experiences can be achieved, only those people who do these soul exercises, that only they can benefit from their experiences. The situation is entirely different. If through the corresponding soul exercises the spiritual facts have come to revelation, then they have been, as it were, at the same time conquered for the whole of human beings. When the spiritual researcher imparts his researches after they have been found, then they can be understood by every human being who approaches them with a healthy sense for truth and unprejudiced logic. We ought not to believe that only a clairvoyant consciousness can have an established conviction of the facts of the spiritual world. Every soul has already been tuned in such a way as to recognize the truth of that which has been found by the spiritual researcher. If the spiritual researcher would present something which is untrue, this would automatically be rejected by the healthy sense of truth and the unprejudiced logic of the hearer. The direct experiencing of spiritual knowledge demands complicated soul paths and soul verrichtung, doing things with your soul. The possession of such knowledge is necessary for every soul which wants to have a full consciousness of its humanity. And without such a consciousness is a human life no longer possible from a certain point of existence. So if even theosophy is able to provide knowledge which can supply the important requirements for the satisfaction of the human soul, and if theosophy acquires knowledge which can be recognized by the natural sense of truth and healthy logic, nevertheless, there remains always a certain abyss between theosophy and anthropology. It is also always possible for the following. One will be able to show the results of theosophy about the spiritual nature of the human being, and then you will be in the position of pointing to the fact that anthropology can confirm everything which theosophy says. Nevertheless, there still will remain a wide path from one of these domains of knowledge to the other domains of knowledge. Nevertheless, there'll be a wide path from the knowledge supplied by anthropology to the knowledge supplied by theosophy. It is possible to fill in this cleft, this abyss, this gap. In a certain connection, this is going to be occurring here through the sketching of an anthroposophy. Anthroposophy is going to be the bridge between anthropology and theosophy. If you can compare anthropology with a person, the observation of a person who travels on a plane from place to place, from house to house, in order to get an idea of the nature of a certain district. And if theosophy is compared to a person who goes up to the height of a mountain and gets a survey of the same district, then anthroposophy can be compared with the view that you can obtain from the slopes of this mountain, where the single aspects still remain visible to your eyes. Nevertheless, your inability of putting together the manifold aspects to a totality. Anthroposophy will observe the human being as it presents itself to physical observation. Nevertheless, it will so foster its observation that out of the physical facts themselves, one will seek for the pointing towards a spiritual background. And so anthroposophy will be able to lead over anthropology into theosophy. I want to explicitly make you notice that here I will designate only a quite short sketch of anthroposophy. A detailed representation would demand too much. The sketch is so thought of that it considers the corporeal aspect of the human being only insofar as this corporeal aspect is a revelation of the spiritual. And in these borders, in these limits, is anthroposophy mentioned. Then, to this anthroposophy, you'd have to attach a psychosophy, which considers the soul aspect. And you'd have to attach a pneumatosophy, which considers the spirit. And with that, anthroposophy then goes into theosophy itself. It ends this first thesis entitled The Character of Anthroposophy, and I can very well understand how and why he did it in this way, because I myself have obtained a very important experience of the relationship of anthropology, anthroposophy, and theosophy, something which I never got clear in my mind before, and now it's clear in my mind. So in spite of all my criticisms, thank you very much, Rudolf Steiner. Now we come to his second thesis, which is entitled Man as a Sense Organism. And here I can tell you he did a marvelous job. He made things very, very clear, much clearer than he did in all those bloody lectures I translated on the senses. He did a marvelous job here. Okay, let's go. The beginning of anthroposophy is to be made by a consideration of the human senses. Through the senses, man comes towards one side into a relationship to an external world. When one speaks of the senses, one should be able to take note of two kinds of things. In the first place, you ought to disregard the ways previously indicated in which man penetrates into another external world, namely into the spiritual world. And then one should, in the first place, disregard whether behind what is observed by the senses there exists a spiritual world. To this spiritual world you should so relate yourself when you speak about the senses in such a way that you wait to discover to what extent, in a natural way, out of the sense observation, there points to the spiritual. So you must neither reject the spiritual world, nor must you presuppose its existence. You have to wait until this spiritual world shines into your perception. We're going to consider not the objects of sense observation, but the senses themselves, the senses as organs of man. And now, on the basis of that which is mediated to man by his senses, man forms himself ideas about an external world. And so there arises knowledge of this external world. And in relationship to knowledge, one can speak of truth and error. If now there arises error in the domain of the senses, the question is, does there arise error in the domain of the senses? Or does the error occur when you make judgments, when you have memories or ideas about what the senses say? Now you're fully justified to speak of the illusion of the senses, the deception of the senses. If, for example, through an irregularity in the ear or in the eye, then a sound or a light impression appears different from that what would occur if you had the normal configuration of the corresponding organs, then you are dealing, for example, with a sense deception. Is it therefore unjustified what Goethe has said when he says, the senses you should boldly trust? They don't give you any falsehood if your intellect maintains its wakeness. Goethe's proposition demonstrates itself as justifiable if you can consider the following. An error which is produced through the intellect or through the memory is something different from a sense deception, from a sense hallucination. A sense hallucination can be corrected by a healthy intellect. If someone, through an error of his eye, represents a tree standing before him as a human being, so he will then become in error if he doesn't correct the mistake of his eye and gazes upon this conjured up human being in front of him as an enemy, and he begins to attack this tree. This is not the same as with an error of the intellect, because there it is the intellect itself which makes the error, and hence the intellect which makes the error cannot at the same time correct its own error. And so real errors of the sense hallucination are produced only through the intellect. Making this distinction is not a pedantry, but it is a necessity. What Buddha is saying here is that you can always use your intellect to correct a deception of the senses, but if you have an error in your intellect, there's nothing to correct it by. Now back to the manuscript. Many people are accustomed, when they speak of sense perception, to count up five kinds: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching or feeling. Here, we cannot remain standing by such a count, because there are still others through which man enters in a different relationship to the external world, different from the hearing or seeing. Even anthropological science speaks at the present time about other senses than those which we have previously designated. Now, it's here not necessary to enter into the number of senses given by anthropology. It only has to be noticed here that here you have a very gratifying point where that particular science, which supports itself only upon the pure sense physical facts, that very science, through its own observations, has forced itself to viewpoints which partly agree with that which spiritual science must establish. Such points of contact will more and more occur in the course of time, and if a good will dominates on both sides, it will soon possible be a time in which there will dominate a mutual acceptance between natural scientific research and spiritual scientific research. Now, from the anthroposophical point of view, everything is designated as a human sense, which enables the human being so to recognize the existence of an object, of a being or a process, in such a way that he is justified in transposing this existence in the physical world. From this aspect, there appears the most indefinite, the most generalized sense, something which one can designate as the sense for life, the life sense. A human being notices the existence of this sense only then when something is taken away from him, when in his corporeality, the natural order, the harmonious order of his corporeality is broken through. When man feels exhausted, he feels filled with tiredness. He doesn't hear tiredness. He doesn't hear exhaustion. He doesn't smell tiredness. He does not smell exhaustion, but he perceives tiredness and exhaustion in the same sense in which he perceives a smell or a sound. Such perceptions, which relate themselves to one's own corporeality, are ascribed to the life sense. In the main, this life sense is always present in the waking human being, even if it is only noticeable when a disturbance exists. Through this life sense, man perceives himself as a self which fills space, as a bodily self who fills space. Differentiated from this sense is that sense through which man, for example, perceives a movement which is performed by him. He moves a leg and perceives this movement. Now, this sense through which this occurs is designated as the sense for one's own movement. The distinction of this sense as compared with the life sense yields itself if you contemplate the fact that through the life sense you perceive something which only is present in the inner corporeality without you yourself doing anything to it. The sense for your own movement is perceived when you have to presuppose an activity. for it. You don't move unless you have an activity to make you move. Whereas the life sense is there all the time, whether you move or you do not. We have a life sense, we have an own motion sense. Now a third sense yields itself when you notice how man is able to maintain himself in a definite position in relationship between above and below, right and left. You can call this the sense for equilibrium, or the statician sense, the static sense. A characteristic of this equilibrium sense yields itself when you consider that one must have a perception of position if you have to maintain yourself as a conscious being. If this equilibrium sense doesn't work, so you fall into a faint and you sink down. A non-conscious object can maintain its position in the same way. The non-conscious object can maintain its position without needing a perception of its position. A non-conscious object cannot fall into a faint. Anthropology points to a small organ within the human ear when it speaks of this equilibrium sense. There you have three semicircular canals which lie in the so-called labyrinth of the ear. If these are damaged, then you get conditions of faintness, you faint away. If you consider the special qualities, the particular qualities of these three senses, the life sense, the motion sense, the equilibrium sense, so you will find that through each of these senses you perceive something which relates itself to your own physical existence. Through his life sense, man achieves a general impression about his corporeality. Through his movement sense, he perceives changes in this corporeality. Through his equilibrium sense, he perceives his relationship to the spatial external world. He maintains these perceptions, nevertheless so that they reveal themselves to him as a condition of his own corporeality, of his own feeling of space. Man acquires through these three senses the impression of his own corporeality as a totality, which is the basis for his self-consciousness as a physical being. One can say that the soul opens through the life sense, through the motion sense, through the equilibrium sense. The soul opens its gates in reference to its own corporeality and perceives this as its first immediate physical external world. The first immediate physical external world for the soul is the person's own corporeality, and the soul perceives this through the gates of these three senses, the life sense, the equilibrium sense, and the sense for motion. Now with the following senses, man enters into a world which does not belong to him in the same way. The first sense coming into consideration here is that through which man comes first into contact with that which one designates as stuff, substance. We get a close connection to substance through the gaseous or aeriform bodies, and this is mediated through the sense of smell. before you can smell any substance, that substance must distribute itself in an aeriform way. Otherwise, you won't be able to smell it. The next stage of sense perception is then no longer that which is purely the substance itself, but when you perceive the workings, the effects of this substance, and this occurs through the sense of taste. Through the sense of taste, you can perceive only a watery body, or such, or something which, in order to be tasted, must first be dissolved into the liquid of the mouth. Through the sense of taste, man is able to penetrate 1 degree deeper into the external substance stuff than through the sense of smell. In the sense of smell, it is the stuff itself which enters into the human being and announces its special characteristic. In the case of the taste sense, that which is perceived is the working of the substance upon the human being. One can perceive this difference best if you hold in mind the fact that with the sense of smell, the gas aspect, the gaseous aspect of the substance enters finished in the human being in order that as it is, it can be perceived. However, with the sense of taste, man first dissolves this substance in his own fluidity, thus and has a change occurs in order that the characteristics of this substance penetrate into him in such a way as previously they did not reveal themselves. Or you can say the sense of smell is adapted to perceive the external aspect of the stuff. The sense of taste is able already to penetrate more into the innermost being of the stuff things, substantial things. And this inner being, man is occasioned to experience, to reveal itself, insofar as he first has to change and transmute the external side of the substance by dissolving it in his own liquidity. Now, still deeper into the innermost being of the external world, man is able to penetrate through the next sense. It is the sense of sight. If the human being sees a body red or blue, that communicates to him much more of the inner being of this body as what is contained in the effect which is mediated to him by his sense of taste. Depends upon the nature of a body if it so relates itself to the colorless sunlight that under the influence of its own nature it appears as red or blue. The color announces itself as the surface of a body, but one can say that how the body announces itself on its surface, that is a result of its inner nature affected through the medium of the light. Dirk Mansell speaking. Rudolf Steiner is saying here that through the sense of sight you get much more into the inner being of the object. If you meditate upon that, because at first sight it doesn't seem right, but if you think more about it you can see it is right, but you have to meditate upon it. It is the inner composition of the object which determines how its surface will respond to the colourless sunlight. Okay? The manuscript. Still deeper, as it were, below the surface of the body is able to penetrate the sense of warmth. you feel a piece of ice or a warm object, then you are clear about the fact that the cold or the warmth is something which appears not only on the surface towards the external as the colour, but you realise that this warmth or cold is something which penetrates and permeates the whole body. Now, you'll notice that the here characterized sequence of stages of the senses, the smell, the taste, the sense of sight, the sense of warmth, that with every subsequent sense you penetrate much more deeper into the inner of the bodies of the external world. A further progress in this diving down into the inner of the bodies is given with the sense of hearing. This leads in a much higher degree into the innermost of the body than the sense of warmth. Sound brings the innermost being of the body into vibration. It is much more than a mere picture when one speaks about the fact that the soul of a body is brought to revelation through the sound. Through the warmth which a body carries in itself, one experiences something about its distinction in reference, its difference from its environment. But through the sound, the own nature, the particular nature, the individuality of the body manifests itself externally and imparts itself as an impression. So far we have dealt with the three bodily senses: the life sense, the motion sense, the equilibrium sense. Then we've dealt with the smell sense, the taste sense, the sight sense, the warmth sense, the hearing sense. Now, when you speak about senses where a knowledge exists without the cooperative working of the intellect of the or of the memory, so you must still add and recognize still other senses than what we have already enumerated. One will, if one places the basis this distinction, you will easily recognize that in ordinary life the word sense is quite often applied in an misappropriated way. So if, for example, you speak of the sense for imitation or the sense for dissimulation, there you are dealing with something in which the intellect, the judgment, is working. And so because of that, you can't say you're dealing with a pure sense activity. However, quite different does the situation stand when in speech you perceive that which reveals itself through sound. It is obviously understood that in the grasping of something which is spoken, there comes into consideration a complicated judgment activity, that you're dealing with a comprehensive soul activity which absolutely cannot be designated with the word sense. However, on this very domain there exists also a simple direct element which is presents itself just as directly as a color presents itself, or as a degree of warmth presents itself, something which gives as an impression before any kind of judgment. A sound is perceived not purely according to its sound value, but something is understood in connection with it of something which is much more of an inward nature than the sound itself. When one says that in the sound there lives the soul of a body, so one could also say that in the sound this soul aspect reveals itself in such a way that it has separated itself, it has freed itself from the bodily aspect, and appears and makes its appearance with a certain independence. Because the perception of sound exists before the process of judging, because of that, the child earlier on learns the significance of the sound of words before he has been able to make use of his power of judgment. The child learns to judge in contact with the speech, with the language. And so it is perfectly justifiable to speak of a special sense of speech, a speech sense or a sound sense, a language sense. The recognition of the sense, of this sense, is made difficult because there is added to the direct perception of that which reveals itself in sound, to that is often added a most manifold activity of the judging process. An exact self-mindfulness will lead you to the conclusion that all of the hearing of that which the basis of what you hear in that which is given to you in the sound, there exists something of a direct relationship, free from every judgment, of the being from whom the sound proceeds, as is the case when you perceive an impression of color. It's easier for you to get an insight into this fact when you realize how a sound of pain directly permits us to participate in the experience of the pain of another being without mixing in any kind of reflective process into the perception. In connection with this, you have to consider the fact that the hearable sound is not the only thing through which man reveals such an inwardness, as is the case with the sound of speech. Also, gesture, mimicry, the physiognomic aspect ultimately leads to a simple, direct experience, which likewise has to be reckoned in the domain of the speech sense as the content of the hearable sound. To a still higher degree, there conceals itself the sense character of the next sense which I have to characterize. If you understand a human being who imparts to us through his gesture or through the sound speech, so there works in this understanding of this other person, primarily there works judgment, memory. Nevertheless, here also a correct self-mindfulness can lead you to recognize that there is a direct understanding which precedes all sorts of reflection or judgment. A feeling for this fact one can best achieve by making clear to oneself how one also can understand that for which you do not need a capacity for judgment. Thus there exists a quite direct perception also for that which reveals itself in the concept, so that one can speak of a concept sense. Man can that which he can experience in his soul as a concept, and can also receive this as a revelation of another being. Through the perception of the concept, one can dive much deeper into the innermost being, into the innermost of a being, than through the perception of sound. A still further penetrating immersion in another being, and that which leads to the perception of what lives in it as a concept, is not possible in a sense way. The concept sense appears as that which penetrates into the most innermost being of an external being. Man perceives with the concept which lives in another human being, he perceives that which lives in himself as in a soul way. So now we've designated 10 senses. We've designated the life sense, the motion sense, the equilibrium sense. We've demonstrated the smell sense, the taste sense. We've demonstrated the sight sense, the warmth sense, the hearing sense. We've demonstrated the speech sense and the concept sense. Now, not in the same way as we've indicated by these 10 senses does there appear the sense character in which one ordinarily designates as the touch sense. This touch sense mediates external impression, pressure, resistance, hardness, softness. If you make present to yourself the nature of that which one designates as pressure, the process is absolutely not a simple one. One perceives in reality not directly the pressing body, but the fact that through it one is occasioned to recede, to push back with this or that place of the skin, or that you have to make a more or less greater strengthening in order to make an impression upon the body. There exists a noticeable difference between this perception and that, for example, which is revealed as a degree of warmth of a body. Even if it is also absolutely correct that a hot person will perceive himself in a quite different warmth condition in a cold bath as a freezing person will perceive when he's in the cold bath, so that in the perception of warmth there is a perceiving at the same time of your own subjective condition. Even if this is true, nevertheless it remains correct that in the main, in the warmth situation, there reveals itself the condition of an external object. This yields a direct relationship of the perceiving person to that as to how the object is. However, the situation is not like that when you say to yourself, one must strengthen yourself or make yourself weaker in order to make an impression upon a body, or to overcome the resistance which offers itself through the hardness or softness of a body. When you say that to yourself, that again is the reflection of an experience which one has in oneself on the body. And even though the fact hides itself, nevertheless it is quite correct. With such a touch perception, the judgment in secret works together. I find a strong resistance. Thus I say the body is hard. Just as it is true that, for example, in the case of the speech sense, you have the perception of something which is a quite direct experience without the entering into of any kind of judgment, so also is it true that with the touch sense there is always hidden with it a very concealed judgment. That which can be perceived directly with the touch sense, that can also be found in the domain of those senses which have been those first three enumerated senses. A body which presses upon me causes, for example, a change in position within my corporeality, and this is perceived either through the life sense or one's own motion sense or one's sense of equilibrium. For all these reasons, you cannot ascribe to the sense of touch as being a separate sense because a certain judgment enters into it. It is very necessary to hold fast the difference of the single sense domains. In every sense, the relationship into which man enters with an external object is something different from the rest of the senses. Through the life sense, the sense of one's own motion, the equilibrium sense, man dives down, immerses himself into his own corporeality, and perceives himself as a being of the external world. Through the smell sense, through the taste sense, through the sight sense, there reveals itself the corporeal nature insofar as knowledge of it is provided towards the external. Through the warmth sense, there reveals itself the inward nature, nevertheless in an external way. With the help of the hearing sense, the speech sense, the concept sense, one is able to experience the inwardness of something which is external to the human being. If one observes the differences of these sense domains, then one will not be tempted to speak so much in generalities of what a sense perception is. One will rather more focus one's attention upon the special relationship into which man appears through every sense to the external world. You don't say very much when you characterize, for example, the sense perception as an impression which is called forth directly through a stimulus of the sense nerves. You very much when you designate a sense impression as something which is called forth in the soul as a result of a stimulus to your nerve senses. Through such definitions, you can quite easily characterize every single sense in a very blurred, generalized way. So you can lose the special characteristic which distinguishes one sense from another. The important point is that the impression which one experiences of the warmth condition of a body is quite different from the impression which is called forth by an impression of light. If you don't consider this, so you will very easily be led, very easily be misled, to place too great a value upon such judgments as the following. Man perceives the external world through his senses and forms for himself on the basis of his sense perception, he forms for himself mental images and concepts. By such a proposition, you are simply confronting sense perception by conceptual thinking. With such a judgment, you are clouding the necessary free view upon the fact that, for example, the sensation of smell stands very far from the experience of the concept. However, the sense of hearing as a sense perception already approaches that which is present in the innermost of the soul as such an experience. Afraid I don't understand what Rudolf Steiner is saying in the last few sentences. Actually, he must be saying something that's very obvious. Really, I mean, what he's saying really is something like this, that you will never realize how different these senses are one from another if you just restrict yourself to the simple sentence which says, man perceives the external world through his senses and forms on the basis of his senses concepts and ideas. What Steiner is obviously saying here, that is simply does not bring to your attention by making that simple sentence, it doesn't make you understand, as he has made you understand in this thesis, the very difference in the character of all these senses. And it's true, he's done a marvelous job in making us understand these different senses, something which you do not realize if you just restrict yourself to that pure platitudinous comment that he just mentioned. So maybe that's a simple thing he said. End of tape.